whatever. And you talk to the guy real nice when you go into the place. He would let you walk into the warehouse, and it was what I would call ham radio aluminum heaven. Against the walls, they had 12-foot and 24-foot length pieces of tubing, every diameter, every wall thickness you could think of. Also, some aluminum sheet. And so, real fun place to go there. When it comes to conductivity of the aluminum, don't worry. You can't buy aluminum that doesn't have enough conductivity to give you a good antenna when you have the right kind of chemical bleaching. About the only thing you have to worry about with your antenna, as I see it, Neil, is physical strength and weatherproofing. My favorite alloy for aluminum is 6061T6. Very, very good output. Very good for survivability of the 6061T6 alloy. And the T6 is the temper hardening, and the 6061 is the alloy. And easy to machine, very rugged, survived for a very long period of time. It's very... tempting to go over to the 2024 aluminum alloy. Do not use the 2024 alloy. Barry used some of that on one of his towers once on a sheet of metal, and it started peeling apart like a mica sheet, if you know what I mean. So don't use 2024, even though it's very easy to machine, and when it's brand new, it looks really nice and shiny, nice piece of aluminum. You put it out in the weather for a year, and the stuff deteriorates real fast. So as long as you're getting 6061T6 or any of the 6061 alloys, you don't have to worry about conductivity. Just make sure it's large enough in diameter to give you the strength you want. Make sure that the pieces of tubing you're fitting together are the right diameters to do that. Your next question really is, where on Long Island do we now buy aluminum? And does anybody have a suggestion on that? Where is there an aluminum dealer, used or new, doesn't matter. Where is there a dealer selling aluminum? Because I think the one that was in that industrial court right off of Grand Boulevard, just a little bit east of Comac Road in Deer Park, I think that guy is no longer there, but I'm not sure. Anybody with a suggestion on that? Give me a call, letters right now, for aluminum dealer. K2LAW in the ThinkNet.
K2, QIQ there.
Go right ahead, Glenn. Where's your favorite aluminum store?
Well, there's two ways of doing it. I have one place that's in Ronkonkoma that sells some really good sheet. If you need sheet aluminum, they'll cut things, but it's very expensive when you're buying it brand new. As far as elements, antenna matches, clamps, but anything you need to build any kind of beam structures, I prefer to use GX Engineering. They seem to have all of the correct ways of insulating the elements, grounding elements, the elements themselves, all the clamps that are necessary, matching networks, balance, just about everything you need to build any kind of HF, VHF, UHF antenna. They have it basically, and you can order it right over the internet and or with a simple telephone call and have it within a couple of days right to your house. KC2, QIQ.
So you just mentioned a place in Ronkonkoma, and maybe you gave me the name of the place, but I didn't catch the name. Here we go, Glenn. So what's the name of the place in Ronkonkoma? Once more time, Glenn.
Change their name, but I think if you look at even just look at some of those engines and things. It's place it takes engineering, and they had all the tubes already in the right lengths you're looking for, the clamps, the insulation pieces, matching networks, just about everything you need to do. It's pretty reasonable prices. KC2QIQ.
Okay, you mentioned something engineering. I missed the word. So metal capacitor, I think, is the name of the plant in Ronkonkoma. And you did say that the brand new aluminum is kind of expensive, and yes, I think that one. And if we could buy used aluminum, a great way to go. You gave me the name of another company, Something Engineering. Want to run that one by again, Glenn? Go ahead.
Sure, it's DX Engineering, Delta X-Ray, DX Engineering. That you go right to their website, and they have every piece of antenna, aluminum clamps, everything that you could possibly need, matching networks, balance, everything that you could possibly need to build a Yagi for HF, VHF, UHF, every little part. And what I've even found also helpful is that the company that took over Cushcraft, and you can buy any kind of antenna part to build a Yagi, VHF, UHF, HF, that you could possibly need, clamps, whatever you need, they either Laird or DX Engineering Deck. KC2QIQ.
Okay, Laird or DX Engineering. Am I correct in assuming that DX Engineering, I think they've been an advertisement in QST Magazine. Is that true, Glenn?
Yes, they do, Dick, but they have a better website. Their website has everything that you could want. And you call them, and they can just about any kind of length of tubing, clamps, insulation clamps that isolate the elements from the booms, grounding clamps, matching networks, balance, anything you could possibly need, they have.
Okay, that's good to know. Alrighty. One more call. Anyone else have any other suggestions for where on Long Island we can buy aluminum? So far we've heard about DX Engineering, Laird, and the metal place in Ronkonkoma. Anybody have any other suggestions for their favorite place in the Long Island or New York City area where you buy aluminum? Give me your call letters right now. H-U-R-I-W-M-A-T-O-N. Go ahead, Wes.
Not Evelyn. Long Island. There is nothing here really reliable. There is a company called Rotax Metals Incorporated, and it's in Brooklyn. They used to play with copper, brass, and bronze alloys, and they do it as now. I don't know. They still do a lot. It's one of the guys, and I have a few others handy. Hold on.
W-O-2-Z. W-O-2-Z. Go right ahead and start up with your name.
Good night. The name is Ian, India Alpha November, and the call is W-O-2-Z. And another company out on Long Island is Fleischmann. That's F-L-I-S-H-E-R, Tube Distributing Corp. And they're at 71 Avenue in Bayshore, New York. Number is 31968-8822. And they have all kinds of tubing and, sheet, aluminum tubing and aluminum sheet. And they'll also cut to whatever length and size you need.
Very fine, Ian. So I think you said Fleischer in Bayshore. You gave us an address. We heard the 71 and didn't hear the rest of it, but just Fleischer or something sounding like Fleischer in Bayshore, lots and lots of aluminum. You also gave us a phone number, something 31968, and we missed the rest of it. I'll back you in for a repeat on some of those. W-O-2-Z, H-U-R-I-W in the TechNet.
And more information to you.
It's 71 Saxon, S-A-X-O-N Avenue, and the number is 63. That's 96882, and it's Fleischer Tube Distributing Corp. I think they've been in business for approximately 20 or some years. not sure if they've always been on Avenue and Bayshore, but they've been in business a long time.
Okay, Fleischer, 71 Saxon Avenue in Bayshore, 631-968-8888 blank blank. Give me the last two digits there on the phone number, Ian. W02Z, K2LAW.
That's 8822.
Okay, good suggestion. Good suggestion. That's a thing. Where are we? Talk about, we got TX Engineering. We got Laird. Quite a few places. Hopefully that's going to do it for you, Neil. K2, Charlie Mike Quebec, K2LAW.net.
I think I have another one.
Okay, give us your other one, Wes, in direct JN, K2LAW.
What do you say?
Indirect JN, K2LAW. Go ahead with your information, Wes.
I've got when I was visiting Rolex Metals, and they gave me that.
Contact about the fox hunting, and at this point, I'm quite interested in doing that.
Very fine, Neil. The best people to get a hold of for fox hunting are Andy is the first one, W2CDL, Whiskey Alpha 2, Charlie Delta Lima. Whiskey Alpha 2, Charlie Delta Lima. Andy is the first guy you should get a hold of. The next guy you should get a hold of is Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar. And the third guy you can get a hold of is Eric, KE2EJ, Kilo Echo 2 Echo Juliet. So, I can repeat all of the information on the metal places if you want me to. And do you need any fill on those three people, Neil? And you're coming through very well. KD2, Charlie, Mike, Quebec, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I guess there's some advantage of being in the shadow of the North Shore Towers. I just missed the last letter, Eric's, the last letter on Eric's call. Over.
Roger, Dodger. Eric is a 2x2 call. Kilo, Echo, 2, Echo, Juliet. Kilo, Echo, 2, Echo, Juliet. So, Andy, Bernie, and Eric, you get a hold of those guys, and they'll treat you very well, and you and any of your friends, you can get to join the effort. As you can tell, this has been going on for 3 years. This particular is, by my standards, a very sad individual, a person, I'm guessing a person with a disability, a person who's out of work, obvious by the fact he can do it at all hours of the day and night. And I'm guessing he's unemployed and living in his mother's home. Back to you, Andy. Neil, if you need any further fills. KD2, Charlie, Mike, Quebec. K2LAW in the TechNet.
KD2, CDQ. No, I've got about the information, and I thank everybody for voicing in, and I'm sure with the information I have, I can find what I need. Thank you very much. Out.
And, Neil, I wrote all this down, so if you have any trouble finding those metal places, call me on the landline, send me an email. I'm mycallletters@arrl.net is the easiest way to get a hold of me. So by hook or by crook, we'll get you the information, you'll get the aluminum, and once you've got a whole lot of aluminum in the house and you're building antennas, it's a fun project. And most of the time, unless you're building a really big antenna, yeah, aluminum in dollars per pound is kind of expensive stuff, but it's a good investment. You buy the right alloy of aluminum, it'll last longer than you and I will, and you'll get a chance to reuse it. I'm also a bit of an aluminum collector. In other words, I've got quite a stockpile of aluminum for all of my projects. So if you have a tough time buying or finding a particular diameter and a particular length of aluminum tubing, aluminum I-beam, would you believe I own a number of 25-foot long H-beam aluminum I-beams, H-beams, that are 6-inch web aluminum I-beams, H-beams. A 25-foot long beam, you put cinder blocks on the two ends, and you put my weight in the middle of 25 feet of this stuff, and it deflects about a quarter of an inch. So I've got aluminum. I collect aluminum, and I collect steel towers, that deal. So hook up my crook, we're going to get you what you need. Next person on the list was Bernie, I think it is, K2 Monkey's uncle. I think it's Bernie, I can't read my own writing. K2 Monkey's uncle, K2RIW, go right ahead.
Yeah, you got it right, it's Bernie, do you hear me okay?
I'm hearing you beautiful, please proceed.
Okay, this is an ultra.
Transformer at all. The raw 60 cycle power, 120 volts of it, gets rectified with a full wave bridge of diodes, goes into a filter capacitor, and now you've got something in the vicinity of 160 volts DC on that capacitor. And you say to yourself, gee, I only want 12 volts or 13.8. That's a great big voltage drop. And if you did that with ordinary analog regulating transistor, you drop 150 volts down to 13 volts, and you're going to be running, you're going to run something like 8% efficiency when you do that. And the other 92% is going to be heat. You don't do that with an ordinary voltage dropping transistor. Instead, what you do is now use a switching network. What does the switching network do? The switching network is going to run at some particular pulse rate. I'm going to pick a number. Maybe your particular device is going to run at a 100 kilohertz rate. In other words, there's going to be an electronic circuit that takes pulses, 100,000 pulses per second. Each of those pulses are going to be turning on the transistor, where the transistor is turned on for some number of microseconds and then off for a very long period of time. If you turn on the transistor, let's assume now I'm going to round off the numbers. Let's assume now that I had 100 volts of raw voltage out of my bridge rectifier and filter capacitor, and let's assume that I want 10 volts out of the power supply. I just changed that because it's a 10-to-1 ratio. And I'm producing pulses of, I'm going to round off the numbers again, 100 kilohertz pulses. That means each individual pulse is separated by 10 microseconds. 100,000 pulses per second means there's going to be a pulse every 10 microseconds. Okay? My circuit is making 100,000 pulses per second, but the pulses are not going to be a nice square wave, symmetric square wave. They're going to be a 10% on, 90% off. So every 10 microseconds I'm making a pulse. In my example, I'm going to make the pulse 1 microsecond on, 10 microseconds off each individual pulse. That's a 10% duty cycle. So my switching transistor running from the raw 100 volts of DC out of that filter network, that transistor turns on for 1 microsecond and then turns off for 9 microseconds and keeps doing that over and over again. You now put that into a inductor input filter network, which averages out all of those pulses. The pulse is going to be 1 microsecond on for 100 volts, 9 microseconds off at 0 volts. You average out 100 volts, 1 microsecond, and 0 volts.
Repeater, timeout.
And 0 volts for 9 microseconds. You average that all out, and it will average to 10 volts. So that inductive input filter network gives you a nice, smooth 10 volts output. The voltage regulator section of your power supply is looking at the 10 volts output. As you change the loading on the 10 volts, higher or lower loading, where the voltage goes up or down a little bit, the electronics is smart enough to make the 1 microsecond on go to 1.1 microsecond on. Instead of 9 microseconds off, it's 8.9 microseconds off. In other words, the circuit continuously adjusts its duty factor, its on to off ratio, and therefore it can keep your output of 10 volts, in my example, accurate to the nearest millivolt of 10 volts, whether you go from no load, half load, or full load. The nice thing about that power supply that I just described is that the real voltage regulation is taking place by way of that transistor that turns on, in my example, 1 microsecond on and 9 microseconds off. So it's either full on, which means it has no dissipation, or full off, which means it has no dissipation. Everything in that network I just described to you is essentially lossless. The diodes, they are quality diodes, they have no loss. The input filter capacitor, it has no loss. The switching transistor going fully on and off, except for a little bit of transition time, it has no dissipation. The output filter network, the inductor input filter network that averages that crazy waveform, giving you a pure DC of 10 volts output, as an example, it has, if it's high quality components, it's got no loss. The bottom line is that a power supply, in my example, a couple hundred watts of 12 volts,
normally would weigh at least 50 pounds and run at around 50% efficiency, you can now have something that probably weighs a couple...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
You can now have something that weighs a couple of pounds and runs at 95% efficiency. As you can see, with modern-day switching transistor networks and the right kind of a operational amplifier and the right kind of a logic circuit that adjusts the pulse duty factor, everything comes out really nice. There's only one slight disadvantage of a switching power supply, and that is it's sitting there making, in my example, 100,000 pulses per second. That's 0.1 megahertz pulses per second. As such, the harmonics of that could give you some grief on your very sensitive HF receiver. As long as you put that switching power supply in a well-shielded box with good design techniques, all of that problem goes away. If you want to see an example of an extremely high quality switching power supply that is known to have, let me drop, that's known to have extremely high reliability, XQ2, I'm trying to think of the call letters now. There's a guy in Chile, in La Serena, Chile, who wrote a series of articles in the, I think it was the December issue in 1999 and the January issue of 2000, a switching regulator power supply, the lead article in QST magazine, this extremely high quality 12-volt switching regulator power supply, designed by this man in Chile. And he wanted to intentionally design it for very high reliability because it was the power supply that keeps the repeaters running on top of the mountains in Chile. And he doesn't like going back to that mountain and switching the power supply and fixing the power supply. So it's a very high performance, very high reliability, inexpensive because he lived a long way away from Santiago, Chile, the capital. He lived 100 miles away from there. He doesn't have a local Radio Shack. He's got to buy all of his parts by mail order. So he had a very nice design power supply. If you want to, and it's a homebrew. In other words, you go to that article, December 1999, January 2000, QST magazine, and if you're... Remember, you can go to the archives and look up that article on that 12-volt power supply, pushing regulator to the power supply. Stand by for a second. equipment. They're awful nice. An awful lot of the power supplies these days are switching regulators. And except for that one little problem of some extra interference they can cause, and there's ways of solving that. Even if you pick up a switching regulator and you like its efficiency, you like its voltage regulation, you like its weight, you like its dollars, but it makes a little bit of radio noise, there's ways of fixing that. Don't let that stop you. So I'll pass it over to Bernie and see if he got some of that. K2 Mike Uniform. K2RIW. Good, Bernie.
Somebody just called me. They said my name. Who was that?
K2RIW.
WKPJ. Do you remember your back door?
I did. I tried using that a couple of times, but all I got is a squeal on it, so it's kind of feedback was taking place. And I don't think it was within my shack. No, it can't be within my shack. Everything turned off, it doesn't have earphones on it. So you do that, K2LIW.
All right. If that gives you a problem, you can use the UHF that's in plain view. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I think I do, yes. In fact, let me try that. Stand by a minute.
Cover 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, that seems to be working rather well. Alrighty, so we got more than one approach. The only slight problem I'm going to have is that when it comes to the people who want to ask a question on 2585, I guess I'll have to listen to them on the input. I think we can do it. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
Oh, I think I got to do something about the antenna at the back door. It's really not pointing your way. That's the problem. Well, you need a little more power, one or the other. All right, we're going to leave it like this for a little while. And eventually we'll try bringing it back, and hopefully the offending signal will go away. So, carry on. If 375 becomes a problem, you're getting stuff, and then I'm going to shut it off.
Understand, Eric. And there's ways that I can give you guys more UHF power. That particular antenna got damaged. It's one of the many antennas that got damaged during Hurricane Sandy. And I'm in the process of improving that system. So I'll maybe by next week I'll have more EIFP on the UHF frequencies. And so my hook of my crook will make it all work. K2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, Dick. You can continue on with the space report, and hopefully everybody will hear that, and we'll go from there. K2RIW, K2J.
Roger, Barry, Eric, and thank you. Hello. Looks like, let's see, am I using the right... I'm using one that works. Could be using this other one. Stand by.
2, 3, 4. Yeah, that sounds a little bit better. Let's see if I can boost the power on this guy. There we go. So, go right ahead with your space report, Paul. It was coming through very well. WS2N. Oh, by the way, I heard that that the meteor that hit Russia, I think the estimate right now is 500 kilotons. In other words, half a megaton of equivalent. Many, many times, like it's like 20 or 30 times bigger than the Hiroshima bomb. The good news is that it's a clean bomb, no nuclear fallout. But over 1,000 people, I've heard as many as 1,200 people were injured. A lot of windows were damaged. If you go to the right YouTube videos, you hear some really loud bang. And two or three of them, the first one was the big one. Apparently the meteor broke up into a couple of pieces, and there's more than one sonic boom. But it gives you some pretty strong evidence that air is a very heavy substance. You put enough energy into air and create a shockwave, and even though that was, let me pick a number, 20 miles above those people, maybe a little bit less, but still, when that shockwave hit the ground, boy, did that do damage. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, what I heard were sonic boom, but... sonic boom will break last year and then maybe. But I think that was a blast. In other words, here's this rock coming in, and the compression on the front of the rock actually compresses that. And by doing that, it blows out the rear end of the rock. You know, it actually explodes. I believe that's what caused the problem. I saw many pictures of it, of the buildings, many of them, and it would be interesting to find out how far that cloud was, you know, the trail, you know, mile away, 2 miles, 10 miles, you know, that would be interesting to find out. I'm sure they'll figure that out if they haven't already there. But, yeah, I want to mention a couple of lines that will be going up this year. One in April, which would be another ATV by the European Space Agency. So it'll be launched out of French Guiana. I've been naming these things. This is the fourth one that's going to be going up to the International Space Station. And this one's called the Albert Einstein. They've had other different names. Da Vinci and all these, you know, they name it after different people. And it docks autonomously on the Russian side. Job. And it stays docked for many, many months. Probably 4 months or so. And then they load up with stuff and it's not reusable. Much bigger. It's probably about three times the amount of cargo than what a Russian spacecraft brings up on the Progress flight. And it'll deorbit and then burn up over the Pacific. It's not like the Dragon, the commercial vehicles that have been going up there. Like SpaceX, of course, that's a much slower payload, but it's reusable. And they're able to bring back science, equipment, whatever they want to preserve, they can bring back and land. With the Dragon spacecraft. And you have another one going up. That's one of the other launches. We'll be going up in a couple of weeks. The third one to the space station by SpaceX. And that'll be going March 1st. It's the special launch date for that. Another one that will go up and we'll come back on a parachute. Land in the Pacific Ocean. Let me drop it. And then you have the... couple of launches that just went up. Last week, a Progress vehicle did go up and is now docked with the space station. And the one that we talked about the previous week, the Landsat Data Continuity Mission, which will eventually be renamed Landsat 8, is successfully put into orbit. And that was launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base by one of our launch vehicles. Atlas V, that same large vehicle launched the Tejas satellite, and that was launched from Florida, and that's now successfully in orbit. Will be permanently located over Hawaii, and they'll have their full capability back again with the Tejas program. But the interesting flight coming up, which was actually in August, but I'd rather bring it up now, is it's a lunar flight called the Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer, or LADEE. And it's an orbital mission. Drop it. Probably about 800, flew over 800 pounds of a satellite will be orbiting the moon. It'll take roughly a month to get there. Not like the Apollo days where they just shoot it up in 3 days. You could launch it on small vehicles. And they have a system where every time you go into an highly elliptical orbit, you know, they actually call it a phase firing. You know, every time you're in the right area, it'll fire its rocket. You know, it's got a higher elliptical orbit, and eventually it gets to the point where it starts to orbit the moon, and then we'll go into a circular orbit, in this case an equatorial orbit of the moon. And it'll do its work for about a half of a year, taking measurements actually of this very tenuous atmosphere that the moon does have. They want to know all the different elements that are in the atmosphere. You think of the moon as not having an atmosphere, but they actually have very small molecules, and different various ones, mineral and oxygen. This thing's going to be able to detect about 25 different elements. And what they would like to do it now instead of, you know, years from now, because as humans get up there with more equipment and people, we're going to change that environment, and we're going to get some readings that you're going to get now. They'd like to know what it is before we kind of contaminate the moon. But an interesting piece of equipment on this Laddie flight, let me drive it, which of course involves communications. You know, my ears always go up, or you know, when I come across that, it is it's a laser. Really a test, but it's a laser that they're going to be using to send data back to Earth. And they call it the Lunar Laser Communications Demonstration. And what it is, it's got this 4-inch telescope mounted on this satellite going around the moon. And it's going to be sending up to 600 megabits back to the Earth. Now, on the Earth, you have receiving optical telescopes, two of them, each one a couple of feet in diameter. And in fact, they're going to cool it down. They're going to use superconductivity on these telescopes. So it's going to be 10 times more sensitive than any other optical telescope. And they're going to see how they deal with the communication of this large amount of data that they want to send back as a test. And they need to do this for future missions, not only to the moon, but to the asteroids and Mars, especially when humans get on board. And, they, you know, even without that, they'd like to have high data rates coming back. You might remember with Galileo, the big antenna didn't open up, so they used a low-gain antenna. And they only got 40,000 pictures back from Galileo going around the moon. But they still probably got a million to drop it. This WS one with the large antenna, that never opened up properly. Well, they want even more data to come back from the planet to the moon. And the only way they can do that is with laser beams. Because the article did talk about, or you know, a lot of us know it's answers. With light, you have a higher frequency, about 10,000 times shorter wavelength than radio waves. So with that higher frequency, you can get a tremendous amount of data rate going back. The interesting part of this, it is solar panels all over. It doesn't have a pressure, no solar panels, it's got solar. Body of it is all solar cells. Doesn't have any big panels sticking out. And I was ripping it. It had almost 300 watts of capability with this WS2N. But the transmitter for this laser test thing, I thought it was I thought maybe 5 watts or something. It's only half a watt transmitting back from the moon, Dick. And it's going to be able to send in over 600 megabytes of data per second. So, interesting experiment. That's what I'm looking forward to. And that's in orbit. By the time it gets in orbit around the moon, it'll probably be September. And, you know, maybe by the time they do the laser test, maybe you're looking at the winter time. But that's it, Dick. That was the space report for this week. Back in that, this is WS1. I'm getting good at hearing voices. I thought that was K2EJ before. Back to you, Dick.
You're absolutely right. That was K2EJ. And he's got a very distinctive voice. Each one of us does. Hey, what's amazing to you is that half a watt can do that from a quarter of a million miles away at the moon with a laser into a 4-inch telescope doing the transmitting. Turns out with laser power, half a watt is a lot of steam. My little laser pointer, that if you and I aimed it into each other's eyes, it wouldn't be at the threshold of damage, but it's not very far from it, and would make you extremely unhappy to have that thing aimed in your eye. And that thing is 5 milliwatts. So the 500 watts you're talking about, 500 milliwatts, half a watt. Let me think now. That's 100 times greater than my little laser pointer. So that's a lot of steam. And when it comes to putting it into a telescope, I probably told you the experiment that I've done. Let me drop. There is a speed sign, a 30-mile-per-hour speed sign. I would guess it's 200, 300 yards down from my house to the west. And when I aim my laser pointer at that, you know, wrap a rubber band around this little switch, put it on a garbage can or on a tripod, and walk down there the 250 yards, I'm going to call it, and it produces a spot on the speed sign. I'm going to guess the spot is around 8 inches in diameter. When I use my telescope, I've got an 8-inch diameter telescope, and I put the laser pointer at the eyepiece of the telescope, and the telescope is focused on the exact same speed sign, it'll give me a spot on the speed sign 250 yards away, and that spot is, oh, I guess in the vicinity of a quarter of an inch in diameter. It's about the size of the spot I would get if my laser pointer and I were standing in front of that sign, oh, 10 feet away. So to use a telescope as a laser collimator, that's what I'm really doing. What I'm doing is that I'm taking the emitting surface of the laser pointer, which probably is somewhere between a 16th of an inch and an 8th inch in diameter, is the actual emitter up on the front end of that laser pointer. I put that into the eyepiece of the telescope, and now the 8-inch diameter of the telescope becomes the emitter. I know because I can hold a piece of paper in front of it and see that the whole telescope is lit up, the whole front end of it, across the whole 8 inches. When you've got an 8-inch diameter collimated beam properly focused, that can give you a really sharp point a long distance away. So that 4-inch diameter telescope on top of the Laddie scope, the Laddie satellite that's going around the moon, I suspect that's going to, as long as they're talking to a place on the Earth that doesn't have great cloud cover, that's going to look like a charm. And I never heard that the moon has got a thin atmosphere. Let me drop. But that makes sense, because they are finding water on the North Pole and the South Pole of the moon. I think mostly the North Pole. And I know that they found water on the North Pole of Mercury. I mean, Mercury is by far the hottest planet in this solar system. And how in the world can you have frozen water? Well, you've got some craters on the North Pole of Mercury, which never get exposed to the sun. They're just looking at cold sky all the time. So all the water that's boiling off everywhere else on the planet Mercury, it eventually collects at that North Pole. And a little bit of that water is left over. Because I'm pretty sure Mercury doesn't have a magnetic field, therefore it doesn't have a Van Allen belt, doesn't have the usual protection, the protective shield we have here on the Earth. So the atmosphere gets peeled away by the solar wind. Give me a couple of words on how James Webb is doing. I think that's supposed to be launched on 2018. That's that really huge infrared telescope, which is going to have more sensitivity than Hubble, and for infrared frequencies, it's going to be able to look through dust clouds, look inside of the planets being formed around suns, and look at the fine details. That's going to be a fun project. So August Lunar, I'm going to call it the Lunar Explorer. I know it's got a much longer name than that. I'm guessing it's got both an RF link as well as this 4-inch diameter telescope with the laser feeding it, probably at optical frequencies, maybe infrared. And as long as you can aim that thing correctly, I'm a little bit worried that the total beam coming out of that, which we can calculate for a 4-inch diameter scope, it probably is going to have a beam that's going to fill up the whole darn Earth, a quarter of a million miles away. I'm back to you for any further comments on all of the above, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Oh, yeah, I'll have the radio communications. This is only a test with the laser. So I want to see how that goes. I know they've done that. They've done laser communication experiments inside the shuttle years ago, but this is a good one, all the way from the moon. That should be good. Yeah, it is. It's always had some kind of a little atmosphere in the moon. I mean, it's very, very small, of course. It's so rare flight, it's not worth talking about, but it's enough to get this to equipment and bothersome if it's the wrong kind of an element that gets some piece of electronics or you might have to deal with a lot of filtering and things that are essential when people are working on the moon or more robots putting the body on the moon. You know, there's a lot of dust and stuff that chews up. And all the astronauts saw some kind of light, some kind of a glow. When they were looking back toward Earth, they always wanted to try to confirm what that was. They want to find out if this is just like fine molecules floating around and, you know, in the orbit of the moon. You know, every time you get an impact or something, you know, stuff does fly up off the surface of the moon and tends to stay there for a while. So they want to find out what all that is. What else? So you had another question, another comment. Let me drop it.
Yeah, I was asking the current status of James Webb.
This is what we're going to be talking about. Robotic missions and a resupply mission to the space station. Any human flights that are going up, of course, will still be done by Russia for the next couple of years until we get going, and maybe we'll hear about a couple of Chinese flights. They do have the capability. They've launched three people at one rocket already, so they're coming up there with capability. As far as we go, it's going to be robotic flights that are presently on the way to different places, New Horizons. Rosetta mission. And of course, like you said, the James Webb. That's still good. There's a lot of equipment that's being built. There's a lot of hardware. They have all the hexagonal discs, I think 36, are already made and built. But just a couple of weeks ago, they had the tertiary disc blast come in. It's actually... That's the only stationary one. So the light comes in, hits the movable glass, like I mentioned this last week, and then goes hits the secondary glass at the focal point. And then it bounces back to the tertiary glass that was finally delivered there. And they're putting that on. But what's yet to be able to see is the gigantic framework and the sunshades and all of this is in development. They got to get this all ready before 2018. And if you bring up their website, you see how it's all unfolded. It's big. It's anybody who hasn't heard about this, it's definitely sitting out 1 million miles away from Earth at the L2 position, Lagrange 2. And it's got this gigantic sunshade, the size of a tennis court. Drop it. WS plant. And so to answer your question, it's being built. Things are coming in little by little. They have on NASA month or so they have an update. Somebody will be talking about it, some new piece that has come in and how it works, what it looks like, and all of that. So looking forward to that launch a couple of years now. Let's see. Yes, you're right. 2018. You got another 5 years before that thing goes into space. Back to you, Dick.
You and I have got a worry. Paul, are we going to be healthy, happy, and whatever 4.5 years from now when James Webb gets launched? I'm looking forward to that one because I suspect that's going to be giving us pictures, in theory, more dramatic than what we've got with Hubble. And Hubble, arguably, is the most productive or the most well-loved piece of hardware that NASA ever built. You're going to have a tough time topping that one, and James Webb potentially could do that. A much bigger aperture, slightly different frequency, a much better location. All of that's the good news. The one piece of bad news is that James Webb will never experience the smallest amount of repair mission. I mean, if it needs a set of spectacles like Hubble did, do you think you're going to fly the shuttle up there and just fix it? Well, it's not going to fly anymore. The shuttle's not going to fly anymore. And the shuttle, you read the shuttle operator's manual, which I own a copy of. If you use every single bit of fuel you've got on board the shuttle, you can't get it above 600 miles above the Earth. And so it's nowhere near the million miles that James Webb's going to be. So, and to my knowledge, we haven't gotten very far yet. Let me drop. We haven't gotten very far yet on robot missions when it comes to repair. Yes, you take, for instance, the Curiosity sitting on Mars right now, the Mars Science Laboratory. That's a very high performance robot mission. But a robot mission to fly to Hubble, latch itself on, go through all the difficulty that a human operator does of opening up those pesky doors, finding ways of closing them again with the straps and everything else. I mean, the Hubble was made to be very serviceable. However, on some of those service missions, they really dug into the guts of the thing, replacing integrated circuits and power supplies that were never intended to be replaced. And they came up with missions to do that. But when you got the adaptability of a human being as the operator doing the repair, then a hell of a lot of the things that you didn't properly anticipate from a quarter of a million miles away, you can adapt. But can you send a robot mission to Hubble to do a repair? To my knowledge, there is nothing on the drawing board to try to do that. I think the best they're going to do is to fly to Hubble, latch onto that mechanism they put on the back of it in order to do a deorbit burn. When at the end of life you want to bring it back over the Pacific Ocean, you don't want it landing on somebody's head in Australia. That would make the world a little bit unhappy if we did that. So to do a deorbit burn from Hubble, yes, but to do a repair of Hubble, to my knowledge, nobody has put that kind of hardware on the drawing board so far. But maybe you know more about this, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
There's no one near us. What else? Mike Massanino. Oh, all right, come out of Long Island. He was the guy that unscrewed all his 36 screws and this one plate had made up some special catch-up device all to get to the power supply and a couple of other things that they wanted to do. They all were near that capability yet, although they are working on things right now. I think about a month ago they had a test on the space station. And what they did was duplicate a refueling mission as if they had a satellite up there. And it's all on the outside of the space station. And they used a combination of the Canadian robot arm and Dexter is like the test outside the gigantic robot. And these two robotic things were not being controlled by any of the astronauts on board, but were being done from mission control. And what they did was remove unscrewed caps from this test gadget, put a nozzle into it, sealed it, refueled it with ethylene. You know, that doesn't freeze, so it's just it's really like landing first. Let me drop it. And duplicate it as, you know, making it as if it was a fuel. Could have been hydrazine, could have been anything. And then it disconnected it, put the cap back on, put a couple back in it. It had the capability. It's to the point now that they said if they wanted to send something to geosynchronous orbit to refuel something, or a satellite, that, even if it wasn't meant to be refueled, they have the capability now of taking that apart. Again, nowhere near the capability of what the astronauts do with Hubble. But they're getting it little by little. They will probably in the near future be able to refuel satellites. Very important, because when you, especially in geosynchronous,